Hello, and welcome to the quarter close edition of PwC's Accounting and Reporting podcast series. Our mission is to inform and educate accountants and other stakeholders on today's hottest accounting topics. I'm Heather Horn, a partner in our national office and your host of this podcast series. In this special episode, we'll break away from our usual five key takeaways format and instead provide you with an audio version of our quarter-end roundup of topics to be aware of as you close the books for the quarter. With that objective in mind, I'd like to introduce Mark Jerusalem, a director in our national office who specializes in leasing topics. Mark will be your narrator today. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mark.
PwC's national office presents the quarter close, first quarter 2019 edition. The sections in this edition include 1, accounting hot topics, 2, SEC and regulatory update. First section, accounting hot topics. First topic, leases, the new standard is here. Most calendar year-end public business entities, or PBEs, adopted the new leases standard on January 1, 2019. Here are some key reminders about the lease disclosure requirements, recently issued guidance for lessors, and implementation considerations to help companies prepare for their first quarter reporting under the new leases standard. We also discuss certain implementation considerations, including the accounting for sale-leaseback transactions, the impairment of right-of-use asset, also referred to as an ROU asset, and build-to-suit leases. Focus on disclosures. The disclosures under the new leases standard are more extensive than under the prior guidance. Further, calendar year-end PBEs will need to include all annual and interim lease disclosures starting with their March 31, 2019 quarterly filings. This is due to the SEC rules that require companies to provide both the annual and interim period disclosures for each interim reporting period in the initial year of adoption of a new accounting standard. Companies do not need to provide the interim or annual disclosures required by the changes in accounting principle standard during the year of transition to the new LISA standard. While the transition guidance of the new LISA standard explicitly removes the requirement to provide the annual disclosures required by the standard on changes in accounting principles, it did not address interim reporting. In March 2019, the FASB issued ASU 2019-01, which clarified that the interim disclosures related to changes in accounting principles are not required during transition. This is consistent with the transition guidance provided in the new revenue standard. During transition, companies have questioned whether a lessee's disclosure of 5-year minimum lease expense and a lessor's disclosure of 5-year minimum lease income from the most recent Form 10-K needs to be carried forward into their interim and annual filings. The standard requires that a company electing to adopt the leases guidance as of the effective date, that is January 1, 2019, for calendar year-end PBEs, provide the disclosures required under the old leases standard for all previous periods that follow that standard. For calendar year-end PBEs, this means that they will need to include the 5-year minimum lease disclosures from their 2018 Form 10-K in each of their 2019 quarterly and annual filings. This is in addition to the 5-year minimum lease disclosures required under the new LISA standard as of and for each of their quarterly and annual filings of 2019. Companies have also raised questions related to whether it is appropriate to combine the right-of-use asset and lease liabilities when they have both operating and finance leases within the same class of asset. The new LISA standard prohibits lessees from including operating and finance lease right-of-use assets and lease liabilities in the same financial statement captions. The ROU assets and the lease liabilities may be included in any financial statement captions that does not result in a misleading representation, as long as the two classes of assets or liabilities are in different financial statement captions. Lessees may want to consider the significance of leases associated with each classification, that is operating or finance leases, in determining where to classify the associated ROU assets and lease liabilities. For more information on the presentation and disclosure of lease arrangements under the new LISA standard, Refer to Chapter 9 of our Lisa's Guide. New guidance for lessors. In December 2018, the FASB issued guidance to simplify lessor accounting by issuing ASU 2018-20. The new guidance requires lessors to exclude from variable payments all lessor costs, such as property taxes and insurance, that the lessor contractually requires the lessee to pay directly to a third party on its behalf. This guidance is applicable even if the lessor knows or can readily determine these amounts. As a result, these amounts are excluded from the lessor's income statement. Conversely, reimbursements from lessees for costs that are paid by a lessor to third parties should be accounted for as revenue by the lessor and shown gross on the income statement. This guidance only applies to payments by the lessee of variable lessor or sublessor costs, and not to the payment by the lessee of fixed or variable rental payments. The new guidance also allows lessors to make an accounting policy election to exclude sales taxes and similar taxes collected from lessees from contract consideration. Finally, the new guidance clarifies that variable payments allocated to non-lease components should be recognized in accordance with other guidance, for example, the new revenue standard. For more details on this guidance, refer to PwC's In Brief, U.S. 2018-25, More Changes to Ease Lessor Adoption of the New LISA Standard. Sale-leaseback accounting under the new standard. As transition to the new LISA standard nears completion, companies are shifting their focus to ongoing lease accounting issues. One issue is sale-leaseback accounting and the interaction of the new LISA standard with the accounting for sales transactions. Sale-leaseback transactions involve the sale of a property and the concurrent lease of all or part of the property back to the seller. Sale-leaseback arrangements are economically attractive for seller lessees in a number of situations, such as generating cash flows or providing temporary transition space to a seller lessee that is relocating to a new property. Under the old lease accounting guidance, prescriptive limitations on any form of continuing involvement made it challenging to achieve sale accounting, particularly for real estate lease sale-leaseback transactions. Often, the seller lessee retained the property on its books and treated the transaction as a financing, that is, a failed sale-leaseback. With the adoption of the new LISA standard, the guidance has shifted from whether the seller lessee has continuing involvement in the property to a focus on whether a sale has occurred. For a sale to have occurred, the seller lessee needs to determine whether control of the asset has been transferred to the buyer lessor following the guidance in the new revenue standard. This requires companies to consider the principles of control, that is, the ability to direct the use of and obtain substantially all of the remaining benefits from an asset and prevent others from doing so. The following are indicators of the transfer of control in the new revenue standard. 1. The seller lessee has a present right to payment, or buyer lessor has a present obligation to make payment. 2. The buyer lessor has physical possession. 3. The buyer lessor has accepted the asset. 4. The buyer lessor has the significant risks and rewards of ownership. And 5. The buyer lessor has legal title. Not all of the indicators need to be present to conclude that control has transferred to the buyer lessor in a sale-leaseback transaction. Rather, the factors should be evaluated collectively to determine whether the buyer lessor has obtained control. As the seller lessee performs this assessment, it should consider the transaction from the buyer lessor's perspective. In addition to these indicators, when assessing whether control has transferred to the buyer lessor, companies must also consider whether there are any repurchase features in the contract. For example, a seller lessee may have the right to repurchase the asset, that is, a call option, or the buyer lessor may have the right to require the seller lessee to repurchase the asset, that is, a put option. Repurchase features must be evaluated under both the new revenue and the new LISA standards to assess whether control has been transferred to the buyer lessor. The standard generally precludes sale recognition when the seller lessee has substantive repurchase option or obligation with respect to the underlying asset, because the buyer lessor would not have obtained control. This is an area that can require considerable judgment, particularly if the contract provides the seller lessee with a right of first offer or right of first refusal. The evaluation of a sale-leaseback transaction is also impacted by the classification of the lease. If the lease is classified by the seller lessee as a finance lease or if the lease is classified by the buyer lessor as a sales-type lease, then a sale has not occurred, as the seller lessee has retained control, and the transaction would be accounted for as a failed sale-leaseback. For more information on accounting for sale-leaseback transactions, refer to Chapter 6 of our Leases Guide. Right-of-use asset impairment. Another consideration relates to the interaction of the new LISA standard with the long-lived asset impairment guidance. Under the new LISA standard, the lessee will initially record an ROU asset and a corresponding lease liability. The ROU asset represents the lessee's right to use an asset legally owned by another party for a period of time. The ROU asset receives accounting recognition as an asset because the lessee has control over an economic resource and is benefiting from its use. The lease liability represents the obligation to make payments for that right of use. The new LISA standard states that an ROU asset is subject to the long-lived assets impairment guidance. Long-lived assets are grouped at the lowest level for which identifiable cash flows are largely independent of cash flows from other groups of assets and liabilities. One way to determine if the asset group should include an ROU asset is to consider if the asset group would have included the lessee's rent expense and its undiscounted cash flows in an impairment analysis prior to adoption of the new LISA standard. The first step in the long-lived asset impairment guidance is to determine whether the carrying amount of the asset group is recoverable. Recoverability is determined by comparing the carrying amount of the asset group to the estimated future undiscounted cash flows expected to result from the company's expected use and eventual disposition of the asset group over the remaining life of the primary asset. If the carrying value of the asset group is greater than the undiscounted cash flows, the asset group fails the recoverability test, and an impairment loss will be recognized based on the amount by which the carrying value of the asset group exceeds its fair value. The new LISA standard does not specifically address how operating lease liabilities and future lease payments should be considered when performing the recoverability test or when calculating an impairment loss. Therefore, companies should make an accounting policy to either 1) include the carrying amount of the operating lease liability in the asset group and include the operating lease payments, the undiscounted cash flows, or 2) exclude the carrying amount of the operating lease liability from the asset group and exclude the operating lease payments from the undiscounted cash flows. Under either accounting policy, there should not be a significant difference in the results obtained in the recoverability test. Further, if a lessee decides to include the operating lease liability in the carrying amount of the asset group, the lessee will also need to make an accounting policy election to either include or exclude the interest portion of the operating lease payments as a cash outflow in the recoverability test. Once an ROU asset is impaired, lease expense is no longer recognized on a straight-line basis, as the amortization of the ROU asset is delinked from the lease liability. Prior to impairment, the amortization of the ROU asset is determined as the difference between the straight-line lease expense and the effective interest calculated on the lease liability. However, once the ROU asset is impaired, the lessee will continue to amortize the lease liability using the same effective interest method as before the impairment charge, whereas the ROU asset will be amortized on a straight-line basis. While performing the impairment analysis related to the ROU asset, certain complexities may arise when identifying the appropriate asset group that includes the ROU asset. For instance, when a company ceases use of a leased building, it should consider whether the determination of its asset groups has changed. Let's walk through an example. Consider a company that leases a retail building with 10 floors. At lease commencement, the company accounts for the entire building as one ROU asset under an operating lease. The ROU asset is the only long-lived asset in the asset group. On January 31, the company ceases use of one of the 10 floors and enters into a sublease arrangement for that floor, which commences on May 31. On January 31, the company reevaluates its asset group and determines it should disaggregate the ROU asset into two separate asset groups, that is, a single floor to sublet, and 9 floors it continues to use. This is because the single floor will not be used for the retail operations and will be recovered with different cash flows than the 9 floors of retail space. Furthermore, the disaggregation into two asset groups may be an impairment trigger for the cease-use floor ROU asset. If it is impaired, it would be written down to fair value, amortized on a straight-line basis, and delinked from the accounting for the floor's lease liability. For more information regarding impairment of long-lived assets, refer to our Property, Plant, Equipment, and Other Assets Guide. For more information on leases, refer to our Leases Guide. Build-to-suit lease transition considerations. Another consideration during transition is the accounting for build-to-suit leases, including derecognition of build-to-suit-related assets and liabilities. In a build-to-suit arrangement under the old lease standard, the lessee was often required to account for the construction project as if it was the owner of the project, that is, the accounting owner. Frequently, a lessee in build-to-suit lease arrangements recorded an asset for all construction costs and a liability for the construction costs that were paid by the lessor. In many cases, the lessee was not able to derecognize the project's assets and liabilities after construction was complete due to the prescriptive sale-leaseback rules. Upon adoption of the new lease standard, if construction is completed by the effective date, that is January 1, 2019, for calendar year-end PBEs, then lessees will derecognize any assets and liabilities that continued to be recognized solely as a result of the previous build-to-suit accounting. The asset is derecognized regardless of whether the lessee would have been the accounting owner under the new standard. However, when construction is still in progress as of the effective date, the transaction must be reassessed under the control-based build-to-suit accounting model in the new lease standard. If the lessee is determined not to be the accounting owner under the new lease standard, the lessee will derecognize any assets and liabilities that resulted from previous build-to-suit accounting. In these situations, it can be difficult to determine how to account for the derecognition of the asset that was created in the build-to-suit accounting. This is because the asset can include lessee-paid amounts that would have been recognized as assets even if build-to-suit accounting had not been applied, for example, leasehold improvements. At transition, the portion of the asset that was not created solely because of the build-to-suit accounting should not be derecognized. For example, assume construction is complete by the effective date. If the lessee would have accounted for its arrangement as an operating lease had build-to-suit accounting not been applied, it must carefully review the payments that it made during construction to determine what the accounting for these payments would have been under operating lease accounting. The lessee's operating lease accounting will differ depending on whether the payment was made for lessee or for lessor assets. Lessee assets. Any amounts that the lessee paid for its own assets would have been recognized as leasehold improvement assets and amortized over the shorter of the lease term or their useful life. Therefore, the lessee must determine what the unamortized balance would have been for the leasehold improvement asset at the transition date and continue to recognize and amortize that amount. However, the amount should be reclassified from the build-to-suit asset to a leasehold improvement asset. Lessor assets. Any amounts that the lessee paid to construct the lessor's assets would have been recognized as a prepaid rent asset and amortized on a straight-line basis over the lease term. Therefore, the lessee must determine the unamortized balance of the prepaid rent asset at the transition date and continue to recognize and amortize this asset. However, it should not continue to be recorded as build-to-suit asset. Instead, the lessee would follow the guidance for any existing prepaid rent asset at transition and should recognize the asset as part of the new ROU asset that will be created for the lease. After adjusting for these lessee-paid amounts, the lessee would derecognize the remaining amount of the build-to-suit asset and liability through equity as a cumulative effect adjustment. Additionally, a lease liability and ROU asset for the lease, adjusting for the prepaid rent as already noted, would be recorded in conjunction with a general transition guidance. For more information regarding build-to-suit accounting transition, refer to Chapter 10 of our Leases Guide. Process and control reminders. The new leases standard introduces accounting and disclosures that may require management to obtain additional information not previously available under their systems and business processes. As a result, companies may need to develop new processes and controls to obtain, analyze, and track the appropriate level of information. Management will need to consider the financial reporting risks associated with each new process and ensure controls are designed and operating effectively to mitigate these risks. The controls should not only address the initial accounting, but also the ongoing reassessment and related disclosures. Next topic, awaiting the finalization of proposed tax regulations related to tax reform. In January 2019, the Treasury Department released the final tax regulations related to the toll charge on mandatory deemed repatriation of certain deferred foreign earnings. These final regulations retain the overall structure and basic approach as the proposed regulations released on August 1, 2018, but also contain some significant modifications. Because the final regulations represent a change in tax law, any impact that this new information has on a company's toll tax liability should be reflected in the financial statements in the period that includes January 2019. Prior to the end of 2018, the Treasury Department also released proposed regulations on a number of other topics, including global intangible low-taxed income, also referred to as GILTI, interest deductibility limitations, and foreign tax credits. While these proposed regulations are not law until they are finalized, they provide insight with respect to the Treasury's interpretation of the law. Calendar year-end companies would have considered the proposed regulations as new information when assessing whether any related tax positions met the more likely than not recognition criteria at December 31, 2018. The final regulations will need to be accounted for when issued, which may be in the next several months. As such, companies should continue to monitor the issuance of the final regulations and be prepared to assess their impact once released. For more information on the accounting impacts of tax reform, refer to our in-depth U.S. 2018-01 Frequently Asked Questions, Accounting Considerations of U.S. Tax Reform. Next topic, early adoption of the new goodwill impairment test. The new goodwill impairment guidance reduces time and effort by removing the second step of what was previously a two-step impairment test. However, the guidance does not impact the timing or order of impairment testing. This guidance is effective for calendar year-end PBEs on January 1, 2020, with early adoption permitted. Companies that adopt the guidance for their annual impairment test must also apply it to any interim testing. For example, assume a calendar year-end company expects to early adopt the new goodwill impairment test in the fourth quarter of 2019 for its annual test. In that case, the company must also apply the new guidance if there is a triggering event in any interim period in 2019. Conversely, if the company performs a trigger-based interim test and recognizes an impairment under the current guidance, it must also perform its annual test using the same guidance. For more information, refer to our in-depth U.S. 2017-03 Measuring Goodwill Impairment to Get Easier, and watch our video, Goodwill Impairment, Considerations When Adopting the New Standard, which discusses additional considerations when adopting the new goodwill impairment test. Next topic, planned LIBOR phase-out. In July 2017, the Financial Conduct Authority, the UK regulator responsible for the oversight of the London Interbank Offered Rate, also known as LIBOR, announced that it would no longer require banks to participate in the LIBOR submission process and would cease oversight over the rate after 2021. Various industry groups continue to discuss replacement benchmark rates, the process for amending existing LIBOR-based contracts, and the potential economic impacts of different alternatives. The replacement of LIBOR is expected to be a continuing challenge for the financial markets and will impact various stakeholders, including financial instrument issuers and investors, administrators, financial institutions, and derivative counterparties. On December 6, 2018, Jay Clayton, SEC Chairman, emphasized the importance of market participants planning for the transition away from LIBOR as a reference rate for financial contracts. Transition is one of the key risks that the SEC is monitoring. Chairman Clayton noted that the Federal Reserve estimates that more than $35 trillion of notional transactions referencing U.S. dollar LIBOR in the cash and derivatives markets will not mature by the end of 2021. The Alternative Reference Rate Committee, or ARRC, convened by the Federal Reserve, which includes major market participants and participation of the SEC staff and other regulators, has proposed the Secured Overnight Financing Rate, or SOFR, to replace U.S. dollar LIBOR in the United States. Some of the benefits of using SOFR include that it is based on direct observable transactions and a market with very deep liquidity. During her presentation at the December 2018 AICPA conference on current SEC and PCAOB developments, the AICPA conference, Sue Cosper, FASB Technical Director and EITF Chair, noted that she believes the expected phase-out of LIBOR may have more impact than some companies expect, calling it a sleeper issue. She believes determining the corresponding standard-setting reaction to a LIBOR phase-out is likely the most important project on the FASB board's agenda. Rahim Ismail, SEC Professional Accounting Fellow, also noted at the AICPA conference that the SEC staff is aware of the potential accounting implications of the transition from LIBOR. He noted that the FASB has been making progress, adding the overnight index swap rate based on SOFR as a benchmark interest rate by issuing ASU 2018-16, and adding a project to its agenda to consider changes to U.S. GAAP that may be needed because of the transition away from LIBOR. Ismail also discussed a consultation from a stakeholder regarding the impact of the anticipated transition away from LIBOR on existing cash flow hedges as it relates to hedge documentation, the probability of certain forecasted transactions, and the effectiveness analysis. For more details, see our in-depth U.S. 2018-27 highlights of the 2018 AICPA conference on current SEC and PCAOB developments. As 2021 approaches, companies should continue to plan for the LIBOR phase-out and monitor communications made by the ARRC, FASB, SEC, and other regulators. For more information, refer to PwC's dedicated LIBOR and reference rate reform page. Next section, SEC and regulatory update. First topic, Brexit accounting implications. As the UK continues to negotiate its exit, companies should be considering how this new political landscape will impact their organizations. Irrespective of the outcome of the negotiations, whether that be with or without a deal, there will likely be significant changes for many UK companies. However, this is not just a concern for UK companies. Brexit may also impact companies doing business with the UK, as well as those with substantial UK operations. For some companies, the UK's future relationship with the EU remains too uncertain to take action. However, by now, companies should have identified and assessed the Brexit-related risks that apply to their company and should be considering the impact on their accounting and financial reporting. Some of the accounting and reporting areas impacted include financial statement disclosures, for example, risks and uncertainties, restructuring, tax accounting, impairment, and valuations. For further details on these and other accounting considerations, listen to our podcast, Brexit, 5 Things You Need to Know About the Accounting Considerations. For considerations under IFRS, see in-depth INT 2018-15. Next topic. Frequency of financial reporting. On December 21, 2018, the SEC published a request for comment soliciting input on the nature, content, and timing of earnings releases and quarterly reports made by public companies. The Commission is seeking feedback on how it can reduce the burden on public companies and improve the efficiency and effectiveness of quarterly reporting while maintaining or enhancing investor protections. Specifically, the Commission focused its request for comment on a number of questions, primarily regarding the following: the content and cost benefit of information reported in quarterly reports and earnings releases, including the potential reduction of disclosure overlap between the voluntary earnings release and required Form 10-Q, the timing of filing quarterly reports and earnings releases in relation to one another, the consideration of earnings releases as a core quarterly disclosure, and the frequency of reporting and alternate approaches for all or some classes of filers. All stakeholders are encouraged to respond to the Commission's request with the comment period ending March 21, 2019. The Commission will analyze the responses and will consider if it should propose an amendment to existing rules. For more information on the SEC's request for comments on earnings releases and quarterly reporting, watch our video, SEC Requests for Comments on Earnings Releases and Quarterly Reporting. Next topic, disclosure simplification. The SEC's amendments to certain of its disclosure requirements became effective for public companies on November 5th, 2018. As part of the amendments, public companies are required to include in their quarterly reporting Form 10-Q an analysis of changes in stockholders' equity for the current and comparative quarter and year-to-date interim periods. The SEC did not prescribe a specified format to present this information. However, the disclosure must be presented in the form of a reconciliation, either as a separate statement or in the footnotes. The SEC previously published clarifying guidance indicating that the SEC staff would allow a public company to defer adoption of the amendment regarding changes in stockholders' equity in their Form 10-Q until the first quarter beginning after November 5, 2018. As such, a calendar year-end public company must include the presentation of its changes in stockholders' equity in its March 31, 2019 Form 10-Q. For more information on the SEC's amendments to update its disclosure requirements, see in brief 2018-21, SEC Simplifies and Updates Disclosure Requirements, and in brief 2018-22, Implementing the Recently Adopted SEC Rules. Next topic, European Union and Non-Financial Reporting Regulations. In 2014, an EU directive, the directive, was enacted to provide greater transparency and accountability of companies by requiring certain non-financial disclosures. The directive establishes minimum reporting standards for environmental, social, diversity, human rights, employee, anti-corruption, and bribery matters. The directive requires certain minimum disclosures, which focus on a company's impact and related policies in these areas, while allowing EU member states to determine more detailed disclosure requirements. The scope of this disclosure is determined by the EU member state and generally applied to large companies, including subsidiaries of U.S. companies, that meet the definition of a public interest entity, or PIE. The EU directive defines a large company as having more than 500 employees and either total equity of at least 20 million euro or revenue of at least 40 million euro. The EU directive defines a PIE as a company that is a company trading transferable securities on the regulated market of any member state, a credit institution, an insurance company, or designated by member states as a public interest entity. The manner in which the final rules have been adopted into local regulations may differ for each member state. Companies need to understand the specific member state rules that apply to determine whether they are in scope, what information is required, and where and how it is to be reported. For more information, see the European Commission website on non-financial reporting. As companies consider the EU directive, they may also want to more broadly consider their environmental, social, and governance, or ESG, reporting. ESG issues have been a frequent topic of discussion among investors, directors, and management. For further information, refer to our publication, ESG, Understanding the Issues, the Perspectives, and the Path Forward. Additionally, our podcast, Sustainability Reporting, 5 Things You Need to Know, discusses the benefits of ESG reporting. Next topic, SAB 74 disclosures and other considerations. SEC Staff Accounting Bulletin, or SAB, number 74, requires a company to provide information on the status of its analysis and the impact that adoption of new standards is expected to have on its financial statements. With the adoption dates for the new Current Expected Credit Losses, or CECL, standard, and other new guidance approaching in 2020, companies' SAB 74 disclosures should become more specific as the effective date of the new guidance nears. In our study of SAB 74 disclosures on the potential impact of adopting CECL in annual and quarterly filings of companies in the S&P 500 between January 1, 2019 and February 26, 2019, we found 2% of filings noted the potential impact of adoption to be material. 11% of filings noted the potential impact of adoption to be immaterial. 43% of filings included only qualitative disclosure or disclosed that the impact was not yet determined. And the remaining 44% included no disclosures regarding the impact of adopting the new standard. As companies are preparing for the implementation of CECL, they should leverage lessons learned from the adoption of the new revenue and Lisa standards, as well as the following best practices to facilitate a successful implementation. Start early and develop a project plan. Identify a complete inventory of accounts and transactions to be impacted. Obtain input from cross-functional groups throughout the company. Consider IT requirements and capabilities of existing and new systems. Understand financial reporting impacts and establish new policies, procedures, and controls. Consider the company's governance and internal control framework when determining the sufficiency of evidence and documentation supporting its significant estimates. Consider engaging valuation experts early on when CECL's implementation is expected to have a significant impact on the company's valuation processes. Communicate early and often with the audit committee and auditors, especially around key judgments. For more information on the new credit loss standard, refer to In the Loop, Preparing for the New Credit Loss Model, Chapter 7 of our Loans and Investments Guide, and In Brief, U.S. 2019-03, FASB proposes targeted relief upon adoption of the new credit loss standard. Let's wrap up with a quick reminder that there are over 15 accounting standard updates that will be effective for calendar year-end PBEs in 2019, 2020, and 2021. There are also over 25 accounting standard updates that will be effective for calendar year-end non-public companies in 2019, 2020, 2021, and 2022. For further details, refer to the appendix of the print publications or PwC's effective dates for new FASB guidance page on cfodirect.com.
To our listeners, I hope you enjoyed listening to Mark as much as I did. Also, be sure to check out the companion online version of the quarter close, which can be found on cfodirect.com. There, you'll find the same great insights as well as links to additional resources. To make sure you never miss an episode, you can subscribe to our podcast series on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you find your content. You can also rate or review our series. I hope you'll join me here again next week as I take back the host seat to tackle five key takeaways related to the phase-out of LIBOR. For PwC, I'm Heather Horn. Thanks for tuning in.
This podcast is brought to you by PwC, all rights reserved. PwC refers to the U.S. member firm or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates, and may sometimes refer to the PwC network. Each member firm is a separate legal entity. Please see www.pwc.com/structure for further details. This podcast is for general information purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for consultation with professional advisors.